Thank you for downloading the African History and Politics Seminar, presented by the University of Oxford's African Studies Center and the History Faculty.
Well, thank you, Georg, for inviting me to come. Really appreciate it. And also, thanks to all of you for making it out, all the way just to hear Tab give a talk. I appreciate it. So, let's get started. Earlier historical writing on the political history of mid-20th century East Africa has been dominated by the narrative of the rise of territorial nationalism. Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, and Zanzibar each have a cadre of works focusing on their national political movements. Two results of this focus on nationalism have been that histories have primarily been written at the territorial national level, and most early political actors and movements have been judged by their contributions towards the future nationalist causes, often showing how their ideas, methods, and agendas were connected to the aims of the later groups. The outcome has been that sometimes the past gets stretched or squeezed to fit within the borders of an author's work, while the aspirations of the historical actors get manipulated in an attempt to show how their contributions to territorial nationalism. Due in part to this trend, the story of the African Association has often been relegated to the prehistory of TANU by writers who are most interested in the formation of nationalism in Tanganyika. And similarly, in the case of the literature on Zanzibar, there is a denial that the African Association in that territory was even fully a part of the organization on the mainland, in an attempt to show how its past actors uniquely contributed to the building of that nation. In order to portray this organization as in line with one of the nationalist trajectories, writers have given that association a territorial focus from its beginning. This is seen in one small way by many scholars' continued misappellation of the organization as the Tanganyika African Association since its inception, when in actuality, it exclusively went by African Association, or one of its Swahili names, such as Umoja wa Watu wa Afrika, the Unity of the People of Africa, until 1948. The issue of naming is more than mere cosmetic semantics, because to a large extent, the organization's name signified its focus and agenda. Therefore, in 1948, when the branches of the Tanganyika mainland broke away from the Zanzibar branches to form the Tanganyika African Association, this coincided with a significant shift in the organization's focus. This change was not predetermined, however, as there was disagreement over this alteration among its members. This revision to the name should instead be seen as a decisive break with the past, a turning point, or the end of an era. In examining the earlier era, from the foundation of the group up until 1948, the most prominent feature of the organization was its Pan-Africanism. In many ways, the African Association during this period had far more similarities with the National Congress of British West Africa than the later Tanganyika African National Union. The AA's Pan-Africanist focus was not solely on reconstructing a divided Africa, like later more narrowly focused Pan-Africanists, although this aspect did show up in its speeches and writings. More encompassing, the agenda of the African Association was to create unity among all Africans at all societal levels, local, regional, territorial, continental, and global. To create this unity, however, the African identity was to be foregrounded, ahead of any local, regional, or territorial identity which could cause division. It was hoped that by unifying under the African banner, Africans would be strengthened in their affairs at any one of these levels. So if Pan-Africanism was the most prominent feature during the early era of the African Association, its chief political goal was to achieve representation at multiple levels. Representation remained a key issue after 1948, but for different reasons. During the early period, the AA's goals was to work in cooperation with the government in order to be the voice of Africans or serve as the government's door to Africans. However, after 1948, specifically 1954, the focus on representation was primarily at the territorial level and was largely used as a way to leverage even more power from the colonial government. This more anti-colonial stance towards representation was not found in this earlier period, pre-48. This paper will re-examine the formational years of the African Association from the 1920s through 1934. The approach of most scholars has been to focus on territorial issues and actors, Seeing the foundation of the AA as a reaction to a territorial issue in 1929, the closer union controversy, and therefore arguing for a territorial agenda from its start. My argument is that the organization did not spontaneously exist to fight for territorial rights in London, but that the association got its start before this date, and that its leaders benefited from and incorporated the concepts not just of Tanganyikans, but other regional and global actors in conceptualizing the vision of the African Association. Instead of judging the African Association by the extent to which it contributed to the future nationalist cause, an attempt will be made to assess the actual intentions of the organization during its early period by looking carefully at the background and context of the organization's ideas at that time. In other words, instead of projecting a nationalist agenda backward, this work attempts to delve back even farther and work its way forward to see how the organization got to where it was by 1929. By attempting to understand how the AA drew inspiration from various political thinkers, both Africans and non-African, it will give a fuller understanding of the development of the group's complex Africanist political program that was interested in multiple levels of representation and a broad range of other issues. While John Iliffe has seen the Pan-African project of the association as unfocused during the early years, only to be narrowed down in an organic way to a nationalist movement, this work argues that from a period before its formal founding, the future members of the AA were already weaving together a number of ideas to create a complex political vision, which was fairly clear, if not overly ambitious, somewhat naive and potentially contradictory, but which was significantly changed in the late 1940s due to a number of internal and external factors, which I won't have time today to discuss. This paper will first examine the way in which two African thinkers, James Augury and Harry Thuku, influenced the future members of the African Association in the 1920s. It will then look at several contemporary figures who helped the association develop its ideas and organize politically. The paper will end with a discussion of the African Association response to the closer union debate that went on from 1929 and 1931, and look at the motivations of the very first acts of and proclamations of the organization. So the most important ideological forebear to the African Association was James Augury of the Gold Coast. In many ways, Augury's views and the way in which Augury's ideas were reconstructed by the AA served as the strongest guiding light for the association in its early years. The most important born in the Gold Coast in 1875, so that's now Ghana, James Augury spent much of the second half of his life in America, where he was educated at Livingston College in North Carolina and Columbia University in New York. He made several significant trips back to Africa, however, in the last 7 years of his life, twice in the early 1920s on educational commissions sponsored by the Phelps Stoke Fund and colonial governments to the western, central, southern, and eastern regions of Africa. Most scholarly interest in Augury has concerned the history or education of African Americans because of his American connection and his educational endeavors. Far less research, however, has been done on tracing out the impact of this transatlantic intellectual on the African continent itself, particularly his influence on African intellectual currents. This imbalance is in need of being addressed because it is likely that James Augury had a greater direct impact on a wider geographic range of African political thinkers than any other single individual in the Anglo-speaking African world in the 1920s, which I'd be happy to talk about in conversation later. In assessing the impact of Augury on the African Association, it must be pointed out that the 3 weeks Augury spent in Tanganyika and Zanzibar in 1924 are very poorly documented. Reconstructing the relationship between Augury and the AA can therefore prove difficult, particularly in light of the fact that Augury not only died 2 years before the formal inauguration of the organization, but there is no record of written correspondence between Augury and the future members of the AA. What we do have, however, are a number of reflections from the earliest leaders of the organization on their personal interactions with Augury in 1924, which speak to the ways in which his ideas shaped their thinking. Furthermore, there are many instances throughout the 1930s and 40s when other members of the AA, those who probably never met Augury, contributed certain ideas and arguments to the Gold Coast Intellectual. There are also several of Augury's addresses, letters, essays, and personal writings by which a solid understanding can be gained of his own thinking and the themes on which he preached. Many of these ideas show clearly in the writings and proceedings of the African Association. Furthermore, there are also quite a few contemporary accounts of the manner in which Augury interacted with Africans throughout the continent and the ways in which they were inspired by him. In tying these strands together, by showing how the ideas and practices of the organization matched what Augury preached and projected, one can gain a fairly good understanding of the ways in which this African intellectual influenced this particular group of East African actors. So in March and April of 1924, as a member of the Phelps-Stokes Commission, James Augury spent 2 weeks traveling throughout eastern, central, and western provinces of Tanganyika, followed by 4 days in Zanzibar town. During these tours, he gave several speeches and spent time interacting with students and educators from both missionary and government schools. On this trip, he also had personal interactions with several Africans who would become the leaders of the three strongest branches of the African Association, Dar es Salaam, Dodoma, and Zanzibar town. On account of his race, Augury was denied entry into the New Africa Hotel in Dar es Salaam, where the rest of the members of the commission stayed. Instead, he lodged with a prominent African teacher of the government school in Dar es Salaam named Cecil Matola. Matola was the son of a Yao chief from Nuwala, and in the 1890s was educated at Zanzibar at Kinugani. This interaction with Augury was said to have aroused the consciousness in Matola about the place of Africans in society. Over the next few years, an informal discussion group began to meet at Matola's house to consider the role of Africans in society. In this discussion group, which included such members as Rawson Watt, Joseph Kimolandu, and Saidi Juma, that formally incorporated into the African Association in 1929, naming Matola as its first president. One of the visitors of this discussion group in 1926 was a young teacher trainee named Hassan Suleiman, who 2 years earlier had met Augury as a student in Kilosa, central Tanganyika. Suleiman's biographer noted that he was inspired by Augury's words about a new dawn for Africans, and that Augury remained a character in the forefront of his mind throughout the rest of his life. Another African at the school that day in Kilosa was Ali Ponda, Suleiman's teacher and a friend of Cecil Matola. Ponda was highly impressed by Augury, especially because he was greatly respected by the director of education who accompanied the commission. Ponda's biographer noted that when he saw Augury, he realized for the first time that it was possible for an African to gain respect from powerful whites if one were well-educated. Suleiman and Ponda both later moved to Dodoma and went on to become two of the most active office holders in the AA branch there throughout the 1930s and 40s. Ponda later served as secretary of the important association-wide conference, which met in Dodoma in 1945. Several years before this conference, in 1936, Ali Ponda had made a trip to Zanzibar to visit the AA branch in Zanzibar town, which was the strongest branch in the association at that time. There, Ponda had met the first president of the AA in Zanzibar, Agostino Ramadhani, whom he revered for his work ethic and dedication to the organization. Like Ponda, Ramadhani, too, had met Augury. When the educationalist had visited Zanzibar, he stayed with Canon Spanton of the UMCA and spoke at St. Andrew's College, Kiungani, where Ramadhani had become the first African head teacher. Ramadhani was greatly taken in by this fellow educator, who awoke in him a sense of African consciousness, according to his son. Ramadhani hung a picture of Augury on the wall in his home, and thus, in a way, Augury presided over many of the early meetings of the nascent African Association in Zanzibar. Much of Augury's time in Africa was spent among the pupils and educators of missionary institutions, but his influence spread beyond Christian circles as he also interacted with many Muslims. One of the most prominent Muslims he came in contact with in Dar es Salaam in 1924 was local businessman Clyde Sykes. The two had reportedly spent some time together exchanging views, and Augury was said to have instilled in Sykes an interest for politics. Sykes also claimed that Augury had left some of his writings for his consideration. Sykes went on to become a founding member of the African Association in Dar es Salaam in 1929 and served in several positions of leadership. Augury's focus on African-wide issues and his willingness and ability to work across religious boundaries for the sake of African unity was a sentiment incorporated into the African Association's modus operandi and adamantly preached for its members by its members for years to come. Augury's legacy, however, was not limited to those Africans he met, and his ideas would continue to capture the imagination of many others who would later take part in the African Association. I want to look closer now at Augury's ideas and how they were communicated to his African audience. Of particular interest are his thoughts on Pan-Africanism and the notion of an African nation. For many of his listeners, including the future members of the African Association, these were novel ideas that made a profound impression upon them. The analysis of Augury's ideas will be followed by an inspection of how these specific elements of his thought were incorporated into the activities and attitudes of the African Association. Most important to the AA's ideological underpinnings and its organizational structure was Augury's use of the concept of the African nation. Augury's idea of the African nation was very different than the one conceptualized by Marcus Garvey at this time. Whereas Garvey was interested in creating a nation state of Africa, ruled by a government structure made up of Africans, with himself as president, conveniently, Augury used the term in a more generic cultural and racial sense as a way to project a unity among all black sub-Saharan African people. This fostering of a Pan-African identity was not unique to Augury. Indeed, African thinkers such as Edward Wilmot Blyden and Augury's Gold Coast contemporary James Casely Hayford had used similar language previously to foster an identity of Africanness. Augury, however, brought this message of African consciousness to large swaths of Africans who had never read or heard of Blyden or Hayford, or for that matter, Marcus Garvey. For early members of the African Association, this rhetoric of an African nation and the brotherhood of all Africans helped them to visualize an African identity that went beyond tribal, ethnic, or territorial thinking. Augury openly encouraged continental thinking among Africans and consistently drew from this larger identity himself. Augury refrained from identifying with his native Gold Coast or his Fanti ethnicity in carrying out his own work, and instead stated that he was working as an African in order to help find solutions to the problems facing the African continent and the people of Africa. Repeatedly referring to Africa, my Africa, it would have been hard for his audiences to miss the fact that he was embracing the continent as a whole, and it is no coincidence that he was known as Augury of Africa and not Augury of the Fanti tribe or Augury of the Gold Coast. Augury embraced and encouraged this view of himself as a representative for the African people, remarking, quote, "I prefer to be spokesman for my entire country, Africa, my Africa." To inculcate the solidarity among Africans, he employed the language of an African family in his speeches and interactions with Africans. While on the educational commissions, he would always refer to Africans as my brothers when he spoke, and would talk of the need of unification among the sons and daughters of a personified Mother Africa. These sentiments would not have been lost on East Africans, some of whom felt a sense of solidarity with this black man from the other side of the continent. Picking up on Augury's sentiments for a shared African identity, Isaac Mosowoya recalled at a committee meeting of the African Association in Dodoma in the 1930s that, quote, "In 1924, Dr. James Augury went through all the world, and everywhere he was going, he was calling us brethren, because he also was an African." Members of the AA also picked up on the theme of Mother Africa, an expression the organization used repeatedly throughout the 1930s and 40s. In Augury's mind, this African family clearly had a geographical home, the African continent, which he thought should be seen as one single unit, even if it had many parts. This was the abode for all the sons and daughters of Africa, and even if some lived abroad, such as people of African descent in America or the Caribbean, they all had a real home back in Africa. Augury would stand in front of a map of Africa and sweep his hands across the continent in a curved motion for his audience to visualize the territory as a whole. Augury would refer to this geographic space as the country of Africa and believe that its natural inhabitants were the members of the African nation. Like all nation builders, Augury thought that African nationals should focus on their oneness and not their differences. Aubrey's talk of an African family and the oneness of Africa was not simply used to create camaraderie at the local level, but was also done to get Africans to look beyond their communities and even their continent so as to inspire in them the desire to make a larger contribution to the global stage. Aubrey believed that Africa was a land of promise, quote, the land and continent of the future, but that Africans first needed to unify and awake to their potential in order to be of larger service to humanity. Furthermore, Aubrey thought the contribution of the African people was unique, and he tried to inspire a sense of the value of their particular role by telling Africans, quote, be proud of the nation to which you belong. If you have a black skin, be very proud of it. God gave you your black skin because he knows that you can do something good in the world that no yellow-skinned man or white-skinned man can. Aubrey believed that the growing racial consciousness, paired with the expansion of the right kind of education, constituted the start of a new era for Africa, claiming that, quote, now the way is open that Africa, my Africa, may be helped to realize herself in order that she may soon take her place in the sisterhood of nations, and under wise guidance stretch forth her hand to God by serving her day and her generation. Significantly in this quote is the clause, under wise guidance, in which Aubrey points to an element of outside assistance in the process of self-realization. Aubrey insisted that for Africa to take its seat among the great civilizations and nations of the world, it had to learn from and work in cooperation with other peoples. Aubrey openly admitted that in his own life, he was a debtor to all men, to all civilizations, and to all kinds of educational programs. Aubrey's approach therefore admittedly entailed a certain degree of imitation, but like other Pan-Africanists, he pointed out that even Britain at one time had no written language and that they adopted certain characteristics from their Roman conquerors, such as clothing and implements of war and methods of manufacturing. Aubrey wrote that just as the ancient Britons borrowed from Rome on their march towards civilization, so Africa should learn from Britain and others as it strove towards progress. Aubrey did not, however, believe that Africa should borrow wholesale from other civilizations such as Europe, but that they should selectively choose the best aspects. Aubrey's willingness for Africans to learn from Europeans, while they began to start their march of progress, led him to the promotion of collaboration between Africans and the European officials and missionaries working in the continent. He took a different tact in this regard than other non-Western thinkers of the day. Aubrey explained his method in contrast to these other leaders. Quote, as against Marcus Garvey's hostility, I preach the doctrine of love and work. As against Gandhi's Indian policy of non-cooperation, I proclaim all the time cooperation. Aubrey's insistence on cooperation did not mean a total disavowal of politics by Africans, but only the abandonment of agitation as an avenue for making their voices heard. Aubrey sincerely hoped that Africans would be able to represent themselves both to and in governments and make their voices known in matters that affected Africa, just as in the way he represented African views of education to the British government and missionary societies. Aubrey's writings carried only the faintest hint of a time in the distant future when Africans would govern themselves. But in the meantime, Aubrey made it clear that the building of an African nation would entail the conscription of European educators and administrators. Aubrey's discussion about the African nation among Africans of various territories inspired many of them to think outside their ethnicity or territory. One contemporary noted that Aubrey influenced Africans in Sierra Leone to, quote, look beyond themselves and to think in terms of Africa. While another Sierra Leonean was so impressed by Aubrey's sacrifice for Mother Africa that he decided to dare for Africa and move to the Gambia to start a school for African children in that territory. Similarly, I've argued earlier that Aubrey's rhetoric and his very presence in East Africa had the effect of awakening an African consciousness among early members of the African Association. I want to look now more specifically at the ways in which Aubrey's ideas were incorporated into the structure and ethos of this early Africanist organization. It was Aubrey's idea about the oneness of Africa and the need for unity among the African nation that had the most foundational influence on the AA. From very early on, the aim of creating unity among all the people of Africa was quite literally written into the African Association's constitution. Furthermore, Africans were reminded by association leaders not to forget the words of Dr. Agri, that it was unity which was the best gift that God had given them. The members of the AA echoed Agri's sentiments when in an association-wide conference it was resolved that, quote, Africa is one country and Africans are one nation, end quote. Put a slightly different way, Saleh Juma of the AA in Zanzibar town expressed to a crowd that the organization stood for, quote, building the African nation, Taifa, which has been divided into different pieces. In order to put Africa back together again and build a strong African nation, the AAA set out to construct an organization that openly encouraged all members of the African family to join and create an association that thereby mirrored the imagined African nation itself. This brotherhood, or umoja, was explicitly extended to Africans from different regions and religions and sects, and the AA claimed to make no distinction between cultured or uncouth, rich or poor. It encouraged those who were uneducated and those ignorant of politics, as well as those of learning and those who were, quote, politically advanced, and who would be willing to endeavor to teach his people what he knows and thereby help the political awakening and advancement of the whole nation, end quote. The advancement of all Africans was taken literally, and although the use of the gender term brotherhood was frequently employed, the African Association made it clear in other places that its unity extended to the daughters of Africa as well, just as Agri had done. Unique to most organizations in the region at this time, the AA also openly discouraged Africans from being divided by tribal or territorial loyalties. The AA resolved that it should be, quote, the duty of every thinking African to consider as his missionary duty the work of helping the abolition of tribal differences, end quote. Heeding this missionary call, a leader of the Zanzibar town branch went to central Tanganyika, where he explained to a black audience that the AA did not care about their tribe, but instead it taught that their tribe was African. The leaders of the organization also desired that Africans of one territory should stay in constant communication with those in other territories, in order to, quote, ensure the quick advancement of all Africans in all parts of Africa. To this end, the African Association employed several strategies for opening up new branches, not only throughout the two territories of Tanganyika and Zanzibar, but in other parts of East Africa and beyond. Like Agri, the African Association was also preoccupied with notions of civilization and desired that Africa would play a larger, more positive role in world affairs. Time and again, members of the AA commented that the purpose of the organization was to make every African aware of the need to follow the road of well-civilized nations. The first step in this process was to create unity and community building. Africans were not to go this transition to civilization alone, however. In one of the very first memorandums written by the newly incorporated African Association, which was addressed to the British Secretary of State for the Colonies, Cecil Matola wrote that he was encouraged to learn that the British government was dedicated to the education of the African native in East Africa and elsewhere in order that it may attain the standard of civilization which will enable him to stand for himself on the equality with other civilized nations in the struggle of civilization, end quote. He went on to say that the whole Africa looks to the British nation wholly and individually to train its head, hand, and heart. This last phrase, a direct quote from Agri's educational philosophy of social efficiency. In this letter, the AA seems to be unilaterally entering into a partnership with the British government. The spirit of cooperation marked the career of the AA throughout the 1930s and 40s. Eschewing the agitation of other groups, the AA was loyal to the British Crown and sought to be representatives of the African people to the government in the places in which it operated. So now, moving geographically north, in 1922 and 1923, several district commissioners of central Kenya were worried about the spread of what they called thukuism. Principally, the colonial commissioners were worried about the expansion of the East African Association and the doctrines of its former leader, Harry Thuku, and particularly the growing interest in politics and those calling for a fuller share of representation. While these colonial officials were worried about the immediate spread of Thukuism in the areas where the charismatic young Kikuyu had preached in 1921 and 22, they probably gave little thought to its spread outside of the Kenyan borders. However, as will be shown, Thuku's legacy can be traced to the neighboring territory of Tanganyika, where the similarly named African Association took up several of his techniques, causes, and ideas in the years following his arrest and deportation. The novelty of Harry Thuku's politics and his legacy in Kenya have received quite a bit of attention from scholars. Many have argued that Thuku made a distinct contribution to the development of modern politics and laid the foundations on which future generations of Kenyan political leaders would build. Thuku's history, however, fits somewhat uncomfortably into the corpus of Kenya's nationalist history. Thuku was one of the first Kenyans to use the political machinery of the British and to organize a political association. He was also one of the first outspoken critics of certain policies of colonial rule, and the memory of his harsh repression of his movement by the colonial Kenyan government served as inspiration for future freedom fighters. However, his adamant struggle for certain issues did not equate to anti-colonialism, and his later loyalist and conservative stance towards the British government after his release shows that while his tactics were ahead of their time, he was still a man of his time who was not calling for the end of colonial rule, but merely changes within the system. This section will examine Thuku's short but influential political career in the 1920s, discuss his connection to the African Association, and show how some of his ethos, organizational ideas, and approaches to politics were incorporated by the later group. At the start of the 1920s, Harry Thuku was working as a telephone exchange clerk for the Treasury Office in Nairobi, and he lived in Pangani, a cosmopolitan African neighborhood in the capital. Thuku was a prominent member of a group of like-minded men who formally got together to talk about the social and political issues facing Africans. This group often met at the home of Abdullah Tarara, a fellow clansman and member of Thuku's age set, in order to discuss a variety of subjects like the rise in taxes, the change in currency, the planned reduction of Africans' wages, and the hated Kapande system instituted in 1919. On 7 June 1921, this group decided to incorporate as the Young Kikuyu Association because, according to its secretary, Thuku, it was feared that if the forward-thinking men of the country did not form a political organization, they would remain voiceless in their own affairs. The members of the group began to reconsider its name soon after informing the public of its formation, and just 4 days later, on 11 June, they were provisionally calling themselves the African Association, with Terada as president. The change came about in part because not all members were Kikuyu, there are at least the two Akamba at this date, and because the association began to realize that they could have an even greater voice if they could demonstrate that their petitions came from more than one tribe. The first act of the African Association was to send an appeal through the native commissioner to the colonial secretary, which pleaded for him to encourage the governor not to reduce the wages of all natives in the country, as many of them had served loyally during the First World War and did not deserve to have their livelihoods diminished. The event that launched Thuku into fame was a baraza, or public meeting, held at the village of Dagoretti, southwest of Nairobi, on 24 June. This important meeting was between colonial officials and the Kikuyu Association, a group of chiefs and other major Kikuyu landholders who had drafted a petition they wanted to discuss with the government. Thuku asked one of his friends if he could attend, and when he arrived, he was asked by Kikuyu Paramount Chief Kinyanjui Gatharimu to be the secretary for the meeting, even though he wasn't a member, because he spoke the best English. At the end of the meeting, Thuku took a copy of the memorandum under discussion home with him. Over the next several days, Thuku discussed the memorandum with his own organization, which had finally settled on the name East African Association by 1 July, and decided to hold their own mass meeting on 10 July to discuss the issues raised. The EAA came up with a list of their own resolutions, which Thuku then cabled with the Kikuyu Association memorandum directly to the Prime Minister and several other notables who might have been sympathetic to Africans' cause. The telegram caused a bit of an outrage as the members of the Kikuyu Association were upset with him for misusing their memorandum, upstaging them, and possibly getting them in trouble with the government, while the Kenyan officials were frustrated that Thuku did not follow protocol and bypass them altogether. Thuku's fame rose meteorically after the telegram incident, and he spent the next several months traveling to different locations to hold meetings to rally Africans to his causes. Buku was not without his critics, however, and many in the Kikuyu community, particularly many of the chiefs from Kiambu district, campaigned against him and his movement. But throughout the next several months, Buku's magnetic orations drew thousands. He bolstered these efforts by utilizing print media, starting his own Swahili broadsheet, Tangazo, which articulated his points to a reading public and also the reading public's listeners. By the end of 1922, Thuku had continued to fall afoul of both the European and chiefly communities, and he was finally arrested on 14 March under the charge of endangering the peace. 2 days after his arrest, a group of several thousand of his followers and onlookers were demonstrating at the Nairobi jail when police fired into the crowd. At least 21 Africans were killed and many more were injured. One of the most unique attributes of Thuku's organization was its multi-ethnic character, which cut across national borders in East Africa. Kenneth King has argued that by using the name East African Association, the group intentionally tried to cultivate a trans-tribal image. Thuku himself reported that the briefly used name, the Young Kikuyu Association, was dropped because the group wanted to show that its complaints came, quote, from all tribes, the Maasai, the Kamba, etc., in order to garner greater sway with the government. Similar to Augury, he desired to demonstrate to his listeners that we were all one family and that there was no difference among the tribes. From the very first East African Association mass gathering on 10 July, all of the meetings were open for all Africans. At this particular 2,000-person strong gathering, Thuku shared the stage with James Mwanthi, a Kamba, and a fiery Luo orator named Abednego. When Thuku traveled, he intentionally went with non-Kikuyu in Kikuyu areas and also journeyed outside of these districts. By 1922, the EAA and members of several Kenyan tribes, Kikuyu, Luo, Luya, Maasai, Nandi, and Akamba, as well as Africans from Uganda, Tanganyika, and Nyasaland. The name East African Association seems to stem in part from both a narrower and more practical view of its constituency, as well as cue taken from the major Indian politicians of the day. One likely explanation for switching the name from the African Association to the East African Association was the realization that in practice the organization would be for East Africans only, and that it was infeasible and maybe incomprehensible to think that it could gain the support of all Africans all over the continent. Therefore, it was in some ways less ambitious and more realistic than the later Tanganyika and Zanzibar-based African Association of the 1930s and 40s. During mid-1921, Thuku did intentionally seek out the Tanganyikan and Ugandan migrant workers in Kenya, and he wrote to the secretary of the Young Baganda Association in Kampala that, quote, "I recognize no difference between the natives of Kenya and Uganda, so far as our future status and education is concerned. What is good for the native of Uganda is equally as good for the native of Kenya," end quote, and thereby showing a sense of commonality among East Africans. Clearly, Thuku was aiming to gain a Kenyan-wide following, and he had started to make interterritorial inroads as well. The naming of Thuku's group and his vision for a grouping of Africans working within the East African sphere likely also had much to do with the Indian political organizations of the day in which he was closely aligned. Thuku had been working directly with several members of the East African Indian National Congress and the Indian Association in Nairobi. Most important among Thuku's Indian contacts was M.A. Desai, who was the leader of the Nairobian Indian community and the editor of the East African Chronicle. Desai not only printed Thuku's broadsheet Tangazo, but he discussed many of the EAA's resolutions with its leader. Furthermore, it was Desai who helped Thuku with the wording of his telegram to the Prime Minister and gave him the names and addresses of the politicians who were likely to take to his cause. Desai was not only the leader of the local Indian Association branch, but under the auspices of the East African Indian National Congress, an interterritorial organization established in 1914, he had convened a conference in Nairobi for all the Indian associations in Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, and Zanzibar in 1919. Desai's belief that a unified East African appeal would have the most weight seems to have inspired Thuku in taking his own East African super-tribal approach. Like the East African Indian National Congress at the time, the East African Association was not limited to members of any particular religion. In the East African Association's case, however, this seems most likely a result of the links forged in the pre-EAA days by the earliest members of the group living in the mixed neighborhood of Pangani. Abdullah Terada, the original organizer and acting leader for a brief period after Thuku's arrest, was a Muslim, as were several others in the group. The early meetings also included several Christians, including Thuku, as well as practitioners of traditional beliefs. The group was motivated most by issues that affected Muslims, Christians, and other Africans alike, and did not appear to get involved with religious questions. During the days of the East African Association, Thuku emphasized this political unification, and, quote, non-sectarian policies were a central theme of his publications. For instance, in a 17 February edition of Tangazo, Thuku described a speaking tour of his when he was accompanied by both a Kavirondo from Maseno in western Kenya and a Muslim from Nairobi, carefully pointing out the fact that they traveled as brothers. He went on to say that this was not a problem because he, quote, saw no difference between the Kavirondo and the man from Kikuyu, or even between the Christian and the believer in Islam. As Kenneth King has pointed out, Harry Thuku was intolerant of religion and fearing with political unity. Another unique aspect of Thuku's political career was his interest in locational politics and the creation of political links between the city and the more rural districts. John Spencer has called this contribution of Thuku's the ruralization of African politics, whereby Thuku was able to add the suggestions of rural Africans to the urban Africans' agenda in order to create a platform that pertained to all Africans and not just the grievances of the chiefs and the missionary educator. To do this, Thuku spent time in the native reserves talking to Africans about the local issues which affected them. Thuku discussed issues such as better access to education, the forced labor of women, the right to cut wood for domestic use, and the granting of the ability to purchase land to ordinary Africans. Most interestingly, however, was Thuku's push for representation for Africans at the local level and the creation of rural councils where non-chiefs or local elite could have their say in matters which affected them. Many authors have argued that these novel aspects of Thuku's political career have been foundational for later generations of Kenyan political actors, but no one has connected the effect of his ideas to the outside of the colony. However, many of the attributes of Thuku's program can be seen in the African Association that was started just a few years later in Dar es Salaam. The primary direct connection that the African Association had with Harry Thuku was through Joseph Kimolando, a prominent member of Cecil Matola's early discussion group, who later served as the vice president of the Dar es Salaam branch in the 1930s. During the critical years of 1920 through 1922, Joseph Kimolando and Harry Thuku were housemates in Nairobi's Pangani neighborhood. During this time, Kimolando undoubtedly had discussions with Thuku about his ideas and his movement, and would also certainly have seen firsthand how Thuku's group was organized and spread to different areas. Kimolando was not the only early leader who would have encountered the spread of Thukuism, as Cecil Matola also lived in central Kenya during 1921. Furthermore, the small African reading public in Dar es Salaam would have been kept up to date on the nature of the Thuku movement throughout 1921 and 1922 from the extensive coverage given in the East African Standard, which was then distributed in Dar es Salaam and other Tanganyika towns. The first most obvious parallel to draw between the two groups was the similarity in name. Both groups seem to have taken the name of African Association to foster a trans-tribal following, to show that they represented a much larger constituency than just a tribe or a particular religious group. Of more substantive importance concerning the influence of Thuku and the EAA on the later AA were Thuku's views on representation and his organizational methods. One missionary contemporary of Thuku noted that what was remarkable about the East African Association was the way in which it set out to learn political and administrative theory. The organization had several branches with their own offices, officers, delegates, and regular meetings. The organization also sent representatives, which traveled to distant districts to get people to sign up to Thuku's causes. In some ways, this was an imitation of the various Indian and European associations, which the AA mimicked as well, But what was unique was the missionary-like effort to reach people outside of the major cities and take the message to the rural areas. I show in detail elsewhere that the African Association also took up this focus on the rural areas, which, like Thuku, became part of the foundation for its claim in representing all Africans. The AA also seems to have followed step in the holding of different types of meetings, having different levels of membership, passing resolutions, and sending petitions to various levels of the British government. At its most basic level, the East African Association served as an example for the AA as to how a like-minded discussion group of Africans could be transformed into a well-organized political and welfare association. The leaders of the early AA discussion group had seen firsthand what could be accomplished. Underlying the issue of organization was representation. Representing African opinions and desires to the government and figuring out how to most effectively do that was of great importance to Thuku and his project. The stated reason for first organizing the group was that African voices would be heard in the running of their affairs, and the expansion of the group to incorporate all tribes was so that Africans could have one great voice when addressing the government. Thuku claimed to speak for a larger African constituency because he felt that voices were not being heard. He pushed for the formation of African councils at all levels, and he wanted local and district councils where Africans could make representations to district officers, as well as municipal councils for the cities. On a larger scale, he wanted to see African members added to the colony-wide legislative council. Like Thuku, at the heart of the African Association's mission was a desire to become the voice of the Africans and to and in the government and form the beginning they desired, and from the beginning they desired Africans elected to local and municipal councils. The desire to organize in order to make representations to the British system was an important development by East Africans such as Thuku in the 1920s, and his pioneering efforts served as a type of blueprint which was handed down to the later African Association. The final way in which the African Association may have drawn from Thuku was regarding the issue of religion. As has been shown, Thuku chose to foreground an African identity ahead of any religious adherence. This practice was taken up by the AA from its beginning. In language that mirrored Thuku's statements that there was no difference between the Christian and the believer in Islam, the AA proclaimed time and again during the 30s and 40s that it made no difference what faith an African adhered to when it came to matters of the association. Religious division should be kept out. In the association-wide conference of 1945, it was resolved that, quote, Africans are first Africans. It is only after that that they are or may be any other things. And it went on to explicitly state that, quote, an African belonging to one religion or sect shall not disassociate himself from another because the latter belongs to another religion or sect, end quote. So the list of characters that influenced and inspired the members of the AA was not limited to those that had gone before, but also included a number of contemporary figures who worked alongside the AA as it started out on its path to becoming a political association. The AA learned from these interactions with a handful of different actors who helped sharpen the association's focus and gave it ideas on how to work with the colonial government. Several of these characters were from outside the territories of Tanganyika and Zanzibar, while others were non-Africans who lived among the members of the AA in the various cities where they operated. This section will look at the influence of the Indians on the African Association during the 1930s, as well as two international characters that inspired the African Association branch in Zanzibar. In its early years, the AA learned from and intermingled with members of the Indian communities and imitated their political activities. In each of the four cities where the African Association opened branches, Dar es Salaam, Dodoma, Bukoba, and Zanzibar, there were active Indian associations who wrote petitions, interacted with colonial officials, and held conferences to pass resolutions. I'm going to skip down a little bit here, but I talk about how, even down to the nitty-gritty details of how they formed their petition, and how the petitions were formatted to the very font that they used were copied by from the Indian Association to the African Association. During the first few months of its existence in Dar es Salaam, the African Association also received specific suggestions for different avenues to pursue by Barrister Ramakrishna Pillai, a prominent member of the Indian community. Pillai had become friends with a couple of the members of the African Association and was asked to discuss politics with the group. At a meeting with the AA on 12 October 1930, which became fairly controversial, Pillai worked through the government's memorandum on native policy in East Africa and explained the rights that Africans had under the British colonial system. Pillai also encouraged the AA to request that Africans from Tanganyika be sent to London to give evidence before the Select Committee on Closer Union in East Africa. It is interesting that through his wider knowledge of the world, Pillai also seems to have helped raise an awareness of a greater Africa within the minds of his African listeners. He gave a discourse on Uncle Tom's Cabin and explained how black people were taken from Africa and sent to be slaves in America. He also told them about Abraham Lincoln, who desired to help blacks advance and put an end to slavery. He then went on to talk about how after the Civil War, many black Africans returned to Africa, where they settled in Liberia. Pillai not only explained some of the legal rights and machinations of politics to the members of Dar es Salaam, but he also fostered an awareness of a larger African community that included the lives of Africans in the diaspora. Outside encouragement was also given to the Zanzibar branch in its early days. Even though the members of the Zanzibar town branch had been in contact with Dar es Salaam branch since before its founding in 1934, it appears that the more immediate impetus for opening a branch on the island came through the interaction with two outsiders. According to one account by an early AA member, a 28-year-old man from America named Burgess came to Zanzibar in 1933. Coming from an America at a time when racial tensions were running high, Burgess was sensitized to racial inequalities and was apparently unimpressed by the way in which Africans were treated. Harnessing the can-do spirit, he was determined to do something about it. While wandering the alleyways of Stonetown, he had an encounter with an articulate African named Adrian Benjamin Boyd. Boyd was a returned slave who had lived in Muscat and India for over 30 years before moving to Zanzibar in 1929. He would go on to become a leading figure of the AA in Zanzibar until 47. Burgess shared his views with Boyd and explained how Africans were treated with injustice and that they had no freedom to live as the white people were living. Burgess had a receptive audience in Boyd who was also concerned with the living conditions of Africans. This was partially the case because Boyd's time in India had made him acutely aware of how far behind Africans were to Indians regarding education. According to this early source, it was Burgess that inspired Boyd with the idea of the need to start an association for Africans in Zanzibar. Soon after these early meetings, Burgess left Zanzibar for Dar es Salaam. In his wake, however, a small group of men began to meet to discuss opening an African association. At some point in 1934, before the official opening of the AA in Zanzibar town, the group was visited by Prince Akiki Nyabongo, the son of the Mukama of the Tora people of Uganda. At this meeting, Nyabongo gave a long speech on the need for African unity and encouraged the men to move forward with their plans for an association, and he promised his help. The branch was officially opened in May of that year, and Agostino Ramadani was chosen to be president with Adrian Benjamin Boyd as vice president. For at least the next 3 years, the African Association stayed in contact with Prince Nyabongo, who was at that point studying for his DPhil here at Oxford at Queen's. Nyabongo worked closely with the Zanzibar town branch in creating their rules and regulations book, a thick document which was a supplement to the constitution which was used by Dar es Salaam. Paul Seme, the secretary of the association, kept in communication with Nyabongo and sought his advice on several issues. The prince also made a second visit to Zanzibar when passing through in 1937. On this trip, he is said to have spent time discussing critical issues with Vice President Boyd. None of the actual correspondence between Nyabongo and the AA still exists, but one can ascertain the kind of issues and themes Nyabongo was talking about at this time through his several writings. In his 1936 book, Africa Answers Back, Nyabongo advocated the exchange of ideas between Europeans and Africans, whereby through mutual respect they would learn from each other as a type of equals. He was even more to the point in a letter to the Ugandan people that stated the principles for which he stood. He explained to his listeners that they should guard and preserve the best of African culture while disregarding all that was worthless. On the flip side, they should adopt the best in Western culture, but adapt it to Africa's special needs and not follow it blindly. He went on to say that education was the greatest blessing that could ever be bestowed on anyone, and quoting Aubrey, that it is necessary to train the head, the hand, and the heart, so that an individual would not become one-sided. More generally, he spoke of the need for unity, pointing out that foreigners had produced disunity by emphasizing differences among Africans. He thought that this could not continue and that, quote, the tribe should no longer be set against tribe, nor sect against sect. We are all brothers. He went on to say that there should be no religious quarrels among Africans, and that one's religious beliefs must be respected. The issue of unity was something also propounded by Martin Kayamba, the most important Tanganyikan temporary who influenced the AA, and who also provided the organization with its oft-quoted motto, unity is strength, umoja ni nguvu. Kayamba was the most prominent and articulate Tanganyikan of his generation. But because I'm out of time, I will have to skip over my thoughts on Kayamba, as well as to lead a section where, against those that argue that the AA began as a reaction to the closer union debates in 1929, and therefore they point to a territorial issue as necessitating the start of the organization, I show how this is a misleading interpretation due to problems with the chronology, and then I show how the wording of their letter to the government on closer union was taken directly from Ramakrishna Pillai, and that it did not fall in with all the other wording and their stated aims at this time. Again, emphasizing that the AA conscientiously pursued a non-territorial approach to African politics. So I will just wrap up by saying that the problem with treating the African Association as only important for writing the prehistory of TANU and searching to find territorial consciousness from the start of the association is that it overlooks the prehistory of the AA. The organization was not, quote, formed to express educated African opinion on the issue of closer union. It was not simply a reaction to defend Tanganyikan sovereignty, nor did it spontaneously exist with an organizational structure in place. Instead, it had been several years in the making, worked out by a group of men who had become interested in finding answers to the questions that faced their community. They did this as Africans, pushing aside other identities that might cause disunity among them. The earliest members of the AA had many ideological depths. Some, like those to James Aubrey and Harry Thuku, were greater than others. The men of the AA weaved together these various intellectual threads over a number of years. They also learned several pragmatic and procedural lessons from a number of their contemporaries. In drawing from these different local, regional, and global intellectual streams, they produced a program that would be instituted over the next several years. Hopefully, what this case study on the AA shows us is that politics and modern political thinking in Africa did not happen solely within territorial borders and as reactions to certain national issues, but that African actors drew from a number of local, regional, and global intellectual currents. Thank you.